So in the Bible, the ideas of heaven and earth are ways of talking about God's space and our space.
So I understand our space really well. We live here. There's trees, rivers, mountains. But my understanding of God's space gets a little fuzzy.
And what we do get in the Bible are images trying to help us grasp God's space, which is basically inconceivable to us.
So these are two very different types of spaces.
Yes, they're different in their nature. But here's what's really interesting is that in the Bible, these are not always separate spaces. So think of heaven and earth as like different dimensions that can overlap in the same exact space.
So we talk a lot about going to heaven after we die, but this idea of heaven and earth overlapping, we don't talk a lot about that.
Which is kind of crazy because the union of heaven and earth is what the story of the Bible is all about. How they were once fully united and then driven apart, and about how God is bringing them back together once again.
So let's go back to the beginning, where heaven and earth, they're completely overlapping.
Yeah, this is what the Bible's description of the Garden of Eden is all about. It's a place where God and humanity dwelt together perfectly, no separation, and humans then partner with God in building a flourishing, beautiful world and so on.
But as humans, we wanted to do things a different way. We wanted God out, and we wanted to create a world apart from him.
Yeah, so we have these two spaces now. And the Bible actually uses lots of different kinds of words and phrases to refer to these two spaces to make a clear distinction.
So you've said that these spaces can overlap, though. So explain how that works.
Yeah, this is where we have to start talking about temples. Because in the biblical world, you experience God's presence by going to a temple. That's where heaven and earth overlap.
Now, there are two types of temples described in the Bible. One is a tabernacle, basically a tent that was built by Moses. And the other was this massive building made by Solomon.
And these temples were decorated with fruit trees and flowers and images of angels and all kinds of gold and jewels and so on. And these are designed to make you feel like you're going back to the garden. And at the center of the temple was a place called the Holy of Holies, which was like the hot spot of God's presence.
Now we can go and be with God again.
But not so fast, because the temple also creates a problem. So God's space is full of his presence and goodness and justice and beauty, but human space is full of sin and injustice and the ugliness that results.
So how do these spaces overlap if they're so different and they're in conflict with each other?
This was resolved through animal sacrifice.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. What do animal sacrifices have to do with this?
Yeah, the idea is this. Animal sacrifices, somehow they absorb the sin when the animal dies in your place. And it creates a clean space, so to speak, where you are now free to enter into the temple and be in God's presence.
Okay, so if I'm an Israelite and I live in Jerusalem, I might be able to be in God's presence. But you said the story of the Bible is all of heaven and earth reuniting.
Right. So we have to keep going in the story where we come to Jesus in the New Testament. And in the Gospel of John, we hear this claim that God became human in Jesus and made his dwelling among us. Now, this word dwelling is really curious. It means he set up a tabernacle among us. And so what John is claiming right here is that Jesus is a temple. He is now the place where heaven and earth overlap.
What's interesting about Jesus is that he isn't staying in this safe, clean space. He's running around hanging out with sinners. He's healing people of their sicknesses and forgiving people of their sins.
He's basically creating little pockets of heaven where people can be in God's presence, but he's doing it out there in the middle of the world of sin and death.
And he keeps telling everyone that the kingdom of heaven is at hand.
And he even told his followers to pray regularly that God's kingdom come and that his will be done here on earth, just as it is in heaven.
But a lot of people are threatened by Jesus and they kill him, which seems to spoil this whole plan to reunite heaven and earth.
But we have to go back to a scene earlier on in Jesus' story where John the Baptist saw Jesus and said, "Behold, this is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world."
So Jesus isn't just talked about as being a temple. He's also talked about as being the temple sacrifice.
Yeah, so the cross is now the place where Jesus absorbs sin to create a clean space that is not limited like animal sacrifices. Jesus' sacrifice has the power to keep spreading and spreading and reuniting more and more of heaven and earth.
And this is all really great, but it leaves one big question in my mind, which is, what happens when I die? Don't I just fly over to God's space to be with Jesus?
Yeah, so a few times in the New Testament, we learn that Christians will be with Jesus in heaven after they die, but that is not the focus of the Bible story. The focus is on how heaven and earth are being reunited through Jesus and will be completely brought together one day when he returns. So in the book of Revelation, we get this beautiful image of the Garden of Eden, now in the form of a city, coming to end the age of sin and death by redeeming all of human history in a renewed creation. And God's space and human space completely overlap once again.
They got 104 of these things out there. It's called the Bible Project. And it began, four years ago, I became aware of it and thought, it's amazing how the complexity of the Bible is sort of put into comprehensible terms and animated to where my kid can begin to understand the stories of the complexity of Scripture. I can begin to understand more of the story of the complexity of Scripture. And so that's what we want to go after today. We're in this conversation called Reclamation. Last week, we looked at reclaiming faith in an age of cynicism. Today, we want to look at reclaiming story in an age of relativity, asking, what is the story the Bible is telling? Is it a story I can believe? Is it a story that's trustworthy among so many other stories and narratives in the world? How am I supposed to live out of that story to make sense of my life and the larger life of God in the world? And so we think this is an important conversation. In the first service, we have this thing that we're going to do now as well. It's called q@marshill.org. And we want to take your questions seriously as the service is going on. To join me today to sort of have this conversation is John Collins and Tim Mackey, the founders of the Bible Project. We're so glad you're here. Welcome to Mars Hill. Glad you're here. As they're coming up, they're going to lead us forward. It's just amazing how much I've learned from this guy. They have a podcast, these guys, and it's so insightful. It's called The Bible Project. 20,000 Twitter followers later and 104 videos. They're just doing great work at helping the Bible be what it is. It's alive. And so how do we begin to understand it in a way in the 21st century that makes sense and that makes sense of us, where we wrestle and struggle and really move through life sort of having a narrative that guides us into full meaning and what it means to be human. And so I'm really grateful you're here. As you have questions going along, feel free to send them. We're going to be looking at the questions and then bringing them up for the last 10 minutes. We're going to bring up your questions that we sort of surveyed and said, yes, these are questions that a lot of people are asking. And so if they don't in their dialogue get to the full thing of what you want to talk about, perhaps there's a chance to actually have that on stage. Here's what I'll say. I just want to set them up for success. This is a short time slot. We're talking like 20 minutes where they're going to riff, and then I'm going to do questions for 10. And it's going to set up a longer dialogue tonight. So if you don't walk out of here with all of your questions answered about the Bible, which won't happen today, so let's just agree that's not going to happen. It's basically to begin to dip our toe into the reality that we want to understand what God is saying in our time, and we want to join that story, but sometimes it's hard to make sense of it. So friends, take it away. Glad you're here.
Thanks, AJ.
Cheers. Yeah. Hello, yeah. Everybody.
Morning.
Behind me.
I'm going to do one quick spin, and then I'm going to sit still. Okay. Thanks for having us. Yeah. We're from Portland, Oregon, northwest corner of our great country. And I grew up in a little town near Seattle. I was part of a church. I grew up in the church. On Tuesday nights, there was a group of people that would get together and go to people's homes who had recently visited the church and invite ourselves in and tell them how to get to heaven. And I did this a couple of times, and it was frightening. It was terrifying and awkward. One time in particular, there's this guy named Adam, and I got his information. And the thing is, I know Adam. Like, Adam and I have hung out a lot. We build skate ramps together. I've slept over at his house. We've teepeed houses together. Like, we've have some history. And so I got to go and do the thing with Adam. So we walk up. It's me and this other girl. We go two by two because it's biblical. And we tell you how to get to heaven. But to open the conversation, you ask this question. Adam, if you were to die tonight, where would you go? And most people answer, I'd go to heaven, I'm a pretty good guy. And then you'd say, great, can I share with you some scriptures? There was five verses we were taught to walk the person through. They're all in Romans 3, Romans 5. They're just kind of scattered all throughout. And so we'd walk through these verses, and I was like, Adam, you got it? And he's like, I got it. I said, do you want to pray a prayer to go to heaven? I do. We do the thing, and it's done. Like, deal is sealed, but I wasn't trained for what to do at this point. Like, once it's done. So I remember one time someone saying that when you get saved, angels are celebrating in heaven. So I said, Adam, angels are celebrating in heaven. All right, see you tomorrow at school. I was just really awkward, and I started to think to myself, you know, what's so special about these five verses that strung together create a code? And what happened in this transaction with Adam? And if these five verses are so important, why did Paul write an entire letter? It's kind of inefficient.
Really good question.
And I read through the book of Romans. I'm like 16. And the book of Romans, it gets kind of, there's a lot of weird stuff going on. He talks about the first Adam. He talks about the faith of Abraham, the heart of Pharaoh, Isaac, and Esau. He's quoting all these Old Testament prophets. I mean, he's like steeped in this story, and I'm just trying to pull things out without recognizing the story that it's seeped into. But this is how I was trained to read the Bible, as like an instruction book. And so I took that on as best as I could, and I actually created a guide for how to read the Bible. The New Testament's easy. You can just grab verses, and it's that simple. But how do you read the Old Testament? Here's my guide to how to navigate the Old Testament. The creation story. This is important to make sure you don't become an evolutionist. Let's just start right there. Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, weird laws. Just stay away from these books. So far, you got it. Old Testament stories. There's good children's church material in here. Also, some of the previous books have this, between the weird laws. Psalms. The Psalms. Lots of worship songs come from here. You need a devotional time. This is the ticket. Try some verses from the Psalms. Proverbs. You can find some great advice in here. Good for type A personalities. Ecclesiastes. Feeling moody? Try this book. Song of Solomon. This is what I did during church. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. These are three really big, crazy books of Hebrew poetry, and I just stay out, but there's some good stuff for Christmas in there. Lamentations, downer book. Maybe try the Psalms. Daniel, cool dudes, great story of faith. Weird visions of beasts, like weird. And let other people argue about how it relates to end times. Finally, the minor prophets. These are smaller versions of the crazy Hebrew big poetry books. Honestly, skip over these. Don't worry about them. But the book of Jonah, that's nice. It's a story. Just don't read the end. It's a bit of a downer. And finally, when all else fails, preach from Romans. So there it is. There's a guide to the Old Testament. And it actually failed me. It didn't work. And slowly, I just kind of started giving up on the Bible. Like, it just confused me. I couldn't navigate it. And I started to become a post-Bible Christian.
The story of John.
Yeah.
I grew up in Portland, Oregon. And I had the opposite experience of the Bible growing up. Namely, I didn't have one.
You didn't read it.
I didn't read it. My family attended church. I wasn't interested. What I wasn't interested in was skateboarding. Mm. And that was the deal for me. So John's memorizing verses at the age where I go into
I was never good at memorizing the verses.
Well, you memorized five.
Yeah, that's
true. You
know,
you apparently changed somebody's life with five verses.
I think I looked them up.
So you're working on that, and I'm working on getting my first skateboard, which was Eddie Radigy, who rode for Team Alva. Anybody? Team Alva? It was the one with the barbarian holding a severed head that he had chopped. That was
it's so biblical.
To me, that was cool. Not the Bible.
There's got to be a story of a severed head in the Bible.
There's actually quite a few.
Yeah, okay.
So just the point being that I didn't grow up engaging the Bible, and therefore I didn't have a framework around me to domesticate the Bible when I finally did encounter it.
Yeah.
So the way I encountered the Bible actually wasn't by reading it. I started going to a skateboard park in Portland that was run by followers of Jesus, and then they would pause the evening. Everyone had to stop skating midway through the night, and they would take 20 minutes and just ask people to listen to a story about Jesus or talk about one of his teachings. And so I went to this, everybody went to this park because it was dry. It rains a lot in Portland, like it snows here. And so for years, I would go on Tuesday nights and just hear these stories about Jesus and the way that he was presented and talked about, and just hearing the stories about how he treated people, it worked on me for years, mm-hmm. my teenage years. And when I got to the point I was turned 20, I just was so compelled by the person of Jesus. And so I decided to become one of his followers, and that was just a huge turning point in my own journey. It still didn't have anything to do with the Bible. It was Jesus that I fell in love with. And so as I began to, like, how do you follow Jesus? Well, you read about him. Okay, there's four books in the Bible that are all about him. Great, I'll read those a lot. That makes intuitive sense. And then you start to realize, like, oh, Jesus talks about the rest of these texts in the book that I'm just reading these four from. He thinks they're really important, and so I'll read them too. And then here it hits the fan. It was just like John had like the confusing Bible, and for me it was the shocking Bible. What do talking snakes and all these sex scandals and those murder, right, and death by the people that God's chosen? Like, and that relates to this, Jesus? Yeah. Like, how are you with me?
I was desensitized to it, I guess.
That's right.
You had a shock factor.
Domesticate it.
Yeah.
And I didn't have that.
Yeah.
But I also didn't have any baggage. Like, I was just like, what does this have to do with this Jesus that I'm really down for? And so that began a journey for me where I didn't have anything going on in my life except skateboarding. And so I signed up for classes at a Christian university in Portland, and that's where John and I met. Mm-hmm. And there, I was introduced to the Bible as Israelite literature, ancient Israelite literature, that it's literature that comes from a people group and a language and a culture radically different from our own, from the other side of the planet, thousands of years ago, and that's the vehicle that God's chosen to speak to his people in all places, in all times. And so that I was hooked. And so I just went on this journey of being in school for too long and loving every minute of it. But eventually, I wanted to be in a learning environment where there were Jews and Christians. And so I ended up doing that, both in the U.S. and in Israel. Life-changing. It was incredible. And so I came to this point where the Bible became this profound and puzzling story at the same time that both illuminated the truth about myself and the human condition, but also pointed me to Jesus in a way that I had never imagined was possible.
Yeah.
And so I moved back to Portland after being in school for too long, and John and I met up, and you talk about what you were doing.
Well, whenever you would come to town, I would just pick your brain because I still have all these questions, and I found that Tim thought about the Bible differently than anyone I had been talking to. And when I had a question, he would go, well, that's a good question, but here's five more questions you haven't been thinking about. The rabbit hole goes deeper. Mm-hmm. And but not only was he helping deconstruct the Bible, but he was helping me reconstruct it as well. And I professionally, I make cartoons for the internet, usually for tech companies explaining their products and stuff. And so I was like, Tim, we need to do this for the Bible. And we started these conversations, and it's been so life-changing and refreshing for me, and it's made the Bible become a center part of my life in a way I couldn't imagine. And these questions of can you rely on the Bible? Is it credible? Is it trustworthy? Is it authoritative? These questions are always spinning in the back of my mind and they continue to spin in the back of my mind. But as we've had these conversations to make videos, I found three paradigm shifts happen in myself that have helped me kind of the Bible to become re-enchanted into my life. So let's talk about those three.
Deal.
I'll set them up. You drive them home.
Deal.
Okay. The first one is that the Bible is human and divine. So I grew up in a faith tradition where you would just, the Bible is God's word. The Bible is divine. It's inerrant. It's infallible, is these words we would use. And so much so that you're kind of like, yeah, let's not really look at the humanity of the Bible. Yeah, the Bible is written by humans, but the Bible's really divine. And we would try to kind of polish off all the human fingerprints on the Bible. And I would come to the Bible going, okay, show me it's divine. I need to find it. And I would just get hung up with all the human fingerprints. I'd get scandalized by it. And what I found was when we started these conversations to make these videos, Tim would constantly be saying things like, look at what these biblical authors are doing here. Look at how they're developing this theme. Look at the structure of this book and how they've done this. And I'm feeling really uncomfortable when he's saying things like this, because it's like, you're talking about the humanity of the Bible. You're not supposed to talk about that. But something really strange happened. And that as we looked at the humanity of the Bible, the literature, these Israelite scriptures, the divinity started leaking out. And I couldn't contain it. And it started just saturating the whole book. And it was really by looking at and wrestling with its humanity was the first time I truly saw it as God's word.
Yeah, our conversations have been really helpful to me over the last few years. Because I didn't have the history with the Bible, I didn't have that hang up when I was introduced to it. It's very public human history. You can actually read a lot about the making of the Bible within the Bible. And what you don't find are stories about the Bible dropping out of heaven. Neither do you find stories about people who are like taken over by the God's spirit or something, and they're just like mute dummies, or you know, like God's just using their arm, not their whole brain and story and culture and life experience. There are stories where people get bowled over by God's presence. They're never stories about the writing of the Bible. When you look in the Bible about the writing of the Bible, there are stories of people in full possession of their faculties that are being used by God so that what they write is what God wants his people to hear. And so somehow there's something broken in our system when the very public human history of the Bible becomes a scandal to followers of Jesus. Like, are you with me? Like, there's something broken, because if you actually read the Bible, that's not at all how it represents itself, is as only divine. And I'm now of the conviction that it speaks to a much deeper issue, and it's particular, especially in the Western Christian tradition, where I think we've misunderstood the premise of the biblical story in a really fundamental way. On page one of the Bible, the whole storyline is generated out of God creating and being the ruler of his world, and he creates and rules his world through human beings made in the image of God who rule God's world on God's behalf. The whole biblical story is
about divinity through humanity.
It's about God's will happening in the world through human wills. That's the whole point of page one of the Bible.
Yeah.
And so why would I expect that the Bible should come into existence apart from a human will? That's how God set up the story. It also speaks to, I think, a shallow understanding of how God's Spirit works in the world, which is always through humans, and through humans who don't become less themselves when they're influenced by the Spirit, but they become more themselves. Mm-hmm. And so to think of these biblical authors as being in a trance as they're writing the Bible, we're short-circuiting the whole thing,
yeah.
Which is that God is speaking into human history through a particular people at a particular time in history through their language and culture and literature. And that's a paradigm shift that we've both been undergoing as we've been doing this project.
Yeah, and then connected to that is the second paradigm shift, which is that the Bible is literary genius. And I remember you first used that phrase, or how that phrase came to be like just this mantra.
I think I said literary ninjas.
Literary ninjas.
And then you said literary genius, yeah. Which is more accurate. Better.
Ninjas are much more exciting.
Although ninjas are awesome.
Yeah. You could picture like the 5-inch punch, right? Like there's so much power and
yes, yeah, and nimble.
Yeah.
Right?
So like that every word subtle. And everything going on is designed in a way for maximum impact. And you know, I can appreciate genius. You can appreciate genius like in movies. I do this a lot. I have my favorite filmmakers. You have your favorite filmmakers. These are guys and girls who understand the craft of making a movie so well. They know the history of it. They know what works, what doesn't work. They know the rules. They know when to break the rules. And they can use all the tools at their disposal to craft an experience that is just mesmerizing. And, you know, painters do this. Musicians do this. And people do this with literature. And I didn't get like a degree in like English major or anything, but you can learn to appreciate good literature, and the Bible actually is literary genius. And as Tim started to show me how it is, and it's not the way we expect as Westerners. It's it's Israeli.
It's ancient Israelite literature.
Israelite literature. But yeah. It's so sophisticated and so well-crafted that once you start seeing that, it's hard to not see it. And as you see it, it just gets you deeper and deeper into it. You see in the Bible what you're looking for. And when you see its literary genius, it's a book that suddenly you realize, this is something I'm going to be able to chew on for the rest of my life.
Yeah, the metaphor that I keep coming back to. I was raised, my imagination was formed in the Star Wars story world.
Yeah.
And so it's like that whole set of scenes in Empire Strikes Back when Luke goes to Dagobah, anybody? And he encounters Yoda. You guys know what I'm talking about? I feel so bad for you if you don't know what I'm talking about. So it's epic. So it's, you know, it's Luke. He's looking for a sage Jedi master. And so he goes, and what he encounters is a silly green creature who talks funny. And what the sage master doesn't do is bonk Luke over the head and is like, here's who I really am. Yoda is patient with the ignorant Luke, just like the Bible is patient with ignorant us. And it just waits for Luke to wake up to the fact that he's in the presence of the sage master. And Luke has to go through his whole journey of transformation until he reaches that point. And Yoda won't force the issue, because it's about Luke coming to own this for himself. And I'm convinced that's precisely the type of journey that we all have to undergo with the scriptures in our own way. We'll find what we'll see as much as we expect to see. And so if you've been trained on biblical children's media, all you will see is ignorant ancient shepherd literature that's good for telling to your children. If you realize that these authors are at the height of a literary tradition in ancient Israel, and this is the top of their game.
Yeah.
And they're engaging and making a historical contribution to the most pressing questions of human nature, of death, of hope and loss, and life and meaning, and about who God, if God exists, who is God behind this crazy world that we're living in? And the biblical authors are making a powerful, one of the most powerful contributions in human history to these issues through a literary medium, mostly of narrative and poetry. And the moment you're able to make that shift, it's just, it'll blow your mind. I can go all day, as John knows, and as our podcasts testify. Just like pick a theme, and you just, from page one, you can follow it through, whether it's the human condition, whether it's humans redefining good and evil, right? That children's story on page three, right? In the tree. And then just watch that narrative of the man and the woman taking, desiring and taking, the knowing good and evil, and defining it for themselves. That's setting a template. These two characters' names are human and life on page three. That's what their names mean.
Yeah.
And then watch it. Every main human Their narratives are have a moment where it's all shaped to echo that story on page 3. So whether it's Abraham and Sarah, when they want to have children, but they don't think they can, so they see an Egyptian slave. They do what is good in their eyes. They take her. He forces
it's the same
himself.
Words.
It's the same. Yes, exactly right. That's right.
Yeah.
So the biblical authors are actually shaping all these stories across the whole collection of scrolls to call back to this moment on page 3.
Biblical authors want you to be sitting back going, I see what you're doing there.
Yeah, that's right. You're supposed to chuckle. You're supposed to smile. The moment that Noah gets off the boat, and you're like, yes, humanity's saved. And he plants a garden, and he gets hammered and naked. And sketchy stuff happens while he's naked in his tent with his son. And you're just like, no, what? This is bad. This is just page 3. But did you expect him to do anything different? He's human, for goodness sakes. And so, anyway, I'm sorry. So... it's genius.
Yeah.
It really is. You don't have to be a religious person, though I think if you are, it begins to open you to seeing a divine-human partnership in these texts in a way that you hadn't imagined before.
The third paradigm...
So you get me going.
Yeah, don't get him going. No, get him going. It's very fun.
Yeah.
The third paradigm is actually our mission statement at the Bible Project, that the Bible is a unified story. And it leads to Jesus. So there's a bunch of books, some are narrative, poetry, prose discourse, but all of it comes together and tells one story. And at the climax of that story is always Jesus. And all this sophisticated literary stuff that's happening, it all ends up coming to a climax with him.
Yes.
And, you know, so the Bible isn't an instruction book. It isn't... a devotional grab bag book. It isn't a bunch of just irrelevant ancient documents. It's a story. And it's a beautiful story that's human and divine and written with literary genius, but all leads to Jesus, who is an actual person.
Yes.
Not just a story.
That's right. The Bible isn't just trying to entertain us. It's trying to... point out our fundamental need for something that we can't seem to be able to do for ourselves.
Yeah.
And the answer to that whole point is not another page. It's a person. And so that's... this is where I come back to the point of the biblical story isn't to just help us engage pieces of paper. It's to point us to a living reality, a living person that we encounter through each other and through the Spirit and in church communities and the bread and the cup. It's a living text, but it is a text and it's meant to be read as one. So that's what we're trying to help people see and invite people into through these videos. And there you go. That's kind of our spiel in a nutshell.
We have some questions.
Videos. What's the website, by the way?
Just thebibleproject.com.
Bibleproject.com.
Yeah, or Google The Bible Project. Yep.
I listen to the podcast quite a bit. A lot of the questions that came in actually aren't about the Bible itself. They're about some of the seemingly contradictions or confusing parts that we read. Like, for instance, I've gotten tons of emails on like atonement theory. And what does that mean? And you actually have a whole podcast where you talk about this. And things like all the stuff on inerrancy and things like this that is discussed over the ministry that you guys do. I think one of the things that I think a lot of us would love to know is how do you... Are there contradictions in Scripture? And yes or no, and what does that mean?
Are there contradictions in a cookbook?
Anyone? Like, is that...
I don't know,
you know what I'm saying?
Means.
What I mean is, what you even notice as a contradiction assumes a whole set of pre-understandings about what a book is for. If I'm looking for a book whose recipes are all the same, well, then a contradiction's going to bother me. But if the purpose of a book isn't to be the... Are you with me? Like, everything hinges on your prior assumptions about what a book is and what it's for. That will determine what is a contradiction to you. So, it's very hard to talk theoretically about these things. You just have to talk about... On pages 1 and 2...
Yeah.
There's a narrative about the universal origins in a 7-day scheme.
Yeah.
On page 1, it's a 1-day scheme.
Right.
On page 1, it goes animals, then humans.
Yeah.
On page 2, it goes humans and animals. A contradiction. Okay, so what I'm being asked to believe is that an ancient author couldn't tell the difference between 7 days and 1 day. And he's that dumb that he's going to put the two together. Contradiction. Are you with me? Mm-hmm. So what I need to ask is, why would somebody put these two narratives right next to each other? And why would there be all these verbal hyperlinking between the two narratives? Apparently, the world, maybe this isn't video camera footage of like the moments of the Big Bang. Yeah. Maybe there's two different portraits, each making theological claims about who we are and where we are and where we come from, and that its purpose isn't to give us security footage. So your assumptions will determine what a contradiction is. And so I think it's more important to talk about the assumptions that drive the questions that we ask.
That may lead into the other one. I think sticking in the theme of contradictions, is there a contradiction between scientific inquiry and discovery in the biblical text?
John's a science nerd.
Yeah.
I'm not.
I don't know a lot about science, but yeah. I'm a science enthusiast. I'm very glad to be living in the 21st century. I really enjoy all the scientific breakthroughs.
I enjoy central heating.
I really enjoyed it this morning.
Scientific revolution. Yes.
Science is incredibly good at it telling us how things work and what things are fundamentally. And that's helped us in so many ways, and it's been great. But what science doesn't tell us is why things matter and what's the purpose of something, the meaning. And that's to get that, which is what we actually crave, you need something more than science. And that's the realm of religion, I suppose, but it's also that's the purpose of story, is to give us meaning. And so I don't think they're contradictory. I think they're very complementary. I think that the Bible is not a scientific book. And if you go to it for science, you're going to be disappointed, or you're going to be trying to find the horizon of a flat Earth.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can link this to the previous question. If my assumption is the Bible was written by a modern American in English, then I would really expect that it's going to connect to the language of modern scientific discovery. But that's not the case. It's an ancient Israelite text. And the dialogue partners of Genesis 1... and two, aren't Darwin.
Yeah.
We're Dawkins. You know, they're ancient Babylonian and Canaanite creation narratives. That's the conversation partner that's being engaged on pages 1 and 2 of the Bible. And once you see that it's a part of that ancient conversation, it just changes the questions altogether.
Yeah, and it's hard to go to that ancient conversation and not feel like, oh, these guys just don't get it. Like, they're dumb, old humans.
But dude, like, in 1,000 years...
we're going to be dumb humans.
Yeah, we're the dumb humans for the people then.
Right.
And that's the nature of the universe. Our knowledge of the universe is always changing.
But they weren't dumb. They were incredibly smart.
That's exactly right.
But their perspective of how the cosmos worked was different. Yes. And we could talk, and it's super fascinating. Yeah. But you got to enter that world without thinking like, oh, this is dumb.
Yeah.
But it's important
to know. It's true for every biblical narrative,
though.
It just gets controversial with certain ones.
Yeah.
I love this question. This is all great, exciting, and true. But what now? How do we begin reading the Bible with this knowledge? Where do we start?
Page one.
Maybe this is more of a practical question.
No, don't start on page one.
it's really easy to be intimidated, especially when you do like the Russian roulette, sort of put your finger in a page and you know, someone dies or you eat food over dung. That's weird. Yep. So like, what do you recommend as a reading diet that would help make sense of the whole? Because you got to start somewhere.
Yeah. This is my take. I'm grateful for my journey that it was Jesus first for a long time, and that was my gateway into the rest of the Bible. And so I really recommend to people to just camp out in the stories and teachings of Jesus for a long time and let the debates lie and just do that. And these stories about Jesus will raise all of the questions, because he's constantly talking about the
rest. Because these stories don't just come out of a vacuum.
That's right, yes. He's talking about the rest of the story all the time.
Yeah.
And then the second thing, this doesn't sound very Protestant of me, but it's Jewish and biblical, is don't read the thing alone. It's a bad idea to read the thing alone. It wasn't designed to be read alone. It was designed for a community, a living, worshiping community, who's connected to the person to whom all these stories point. And so you're not designed to be able to read it on your own.
You read the book by yourself. Come on.
No, dude, look at my bookshelf. I'm reading it in dialogue with these other people.
Yeah.
And that's a part of the role of a living community of faith, is to become the commentary that you use to read with. And so that's a practical, because you're going to come up with so many questions that you're not going to be able to solve on your own. You need your community of faith and the nerds in your community of faith to help you find a way forward.
So start with Jesus and maybe scale out from there.
If somebody doesn't know anything,
yeah,
start with Jesus, yeah, and then range outwards from there.
Here's a really good question. The deeper you go, the more questions surface.
Yes.
How do you balance diving deep enough to find the weight of the meaning of the stories without being lost in the cynicism of the interpretations and who is getting the details right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that what I'm learning is that the Bible isn't just saying, hey, take this whatever direction you want to take this. Mm. It's not like, hey, this could be 1,000 different interpretations. Just kind of run where your heart is leading. That the authors are trying to say something, but they're just doing it in a way that allows you time and space to get there slowly and see how profound it really is what they're saying. And the Bible will interpret itself as you read it as a unified story.
Yeah.
And so it shouldn't leave you in a space of going, well, who knows? This guy says this guy says that. It should lead you into a space where you're like, wow, it's saying that about the human condition. Yeah.
Could it be this? Could it be this? Apparently this author didn't want to clarify that. And that must be on purpose to push me forward to the next page.
Yeah. We talk about spelunking.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, if there are ambiguities that people are debating about, it's 9 times out of 10, they're there intentionally to guide you into the narrative and to find the question 300 pages down the front, the answer. That helps solve that 300 pages later. It's like a well-designed museum exhibit, and nothing is unintentional. Yeah. And so when you're reading through the narrative, and every question that you have, Jews have been reading the Bible 1,000 years longer than Christians have. Every question that has ever occurred to you when you're reading the Bible has been asked by tens of thousands of people before you. So there's no reason to be cynical. This is what a wonderful gift to engage God's people for millennia than this narrative that gives us clarity on the big picture, but is so dense and engaging on the micro level as you read from page to page.
Yeah, what excites me is that you'll be around tonight and that we're going to be talking about the Bible in justice, the Bible in character, and how that works. And they'll also be around as you leave if you have just more questions that are pressing. But also there's like this amazing treasure trove that they've been up to for the last how many years now? 10?
4 years.
4 years? 4,000 years. They've been working on this thing for 4,000 years. For 4 years. That's when I got to know. So I was pretty close to
you. You were early adopter.
Thanks be to God.
Yeah.
So there's so many ways you can search themes of things that you're wondering, and whether it's sort of like a podcast moment like this, or whether it's a video that you can actually watch an animation to begin to sort of make sense. And really what has happened for me in my story is that I found that a lot of my just, there are seasons where I just sludge through because it begins to like make sense of me more than me making sense of it. There's like a strange reciprocity that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Many of you know that as Lectio Divina, this sort of like way in which you give the text permission to ask you questions, and way in which some of the questions you have about the text, you struggle with it. I mean, that was the name for Israel that we get grafted into as the church. That's our name is that we are grafted into that. And so it is our opportunity to struggle, to struggle not just with the text, but with one another in the text.
The Bible creates the environment
in
which God's people struggle with God.
And maybe that certitudes, like maybe that's part of the journey that God's asking us to say, would you trust in the midst of this and I'll make sense over time.
Yeah,
so thank you for being here. I'm so grateful for
you
both and what you do.
Thanks for having us.
And we're glad to have you at Marcel today.
Yeah.